Welcome to another episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. Today is Monday, August 22nd, 2022. I'm your host, Audrey Sternberg. Doctors Robert Stuver and Zachary D. Epstein-Peterson, both of the lymphoma service in the Department of Medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, spoke with Cancer Network about their review published in the journal Oncology titled Current Treatment of Peripheral T-Cell Lymphoma. In the article, Stuver and Epstein-Peterson explored current approaches to the diagnosis and treatment of peripheral T-cell lymphoma and novel emerging strategies clinicians who are practicing in the community should be aware of. Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm here with Drs. Robert Stuver and Zachary Epstein-Peterson, both from the Lymphoma Service, Department of Medicine, at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. How are you doing today?
We're doing well. Thanks for having us.
Doing well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So we're here to discuss your manuscript titled Current Treatment of Peripheral T-Cell Lymphoma, which is part of the Oncology Series Annual Review of Treatments in Hematologic Malignancies, spearheaded by Oncology Co-Editor-in-Chief, Dr. Julie Vose. This manuscript was co-authored by your colleagues at Memorial Sloan Kettering. So let's jump right into the questions. Can you review current standards for diagnosis of and molecular testing in peripheral T-cell lymphoma, or PTCL? And here you can touch on gold standards, preferred methods, challenges, or future directions in the space.
Great, so I'll tackle that first question, and thanks for giving us this platform. As many of our listeners probably know, T-cell lymphomas are very rare hematologic malignancies. They really make up just a slice of all lymphomas diagnosed in the United States annually. Annually, there's about 100,000 cases of lymphoma, and T-cell lymphomas are just about 5% of those cases. And T-cell lymphomas is actually a category of diseases. It's upwards of 30 different diseases. So the first step in treating these diseases is actually making the diagnosis, which can actually be quite challenging. We're fortunate at Memorial Sloan Kettering to have a group of pathologists that really specialize in this area, but really, any diagnosis starts with a pathology review, and that includes histopathology. Other components that are key in terms of making the diagnosis of T-cell lymphoma include using immunohistochemistry for certain T-cell markers, and flow cytometry can evaluate surface cell markers as well. What's really key about T-cell lymphomas in terms of looking at cell surface markers is that there's often loss of T cell antigens. So the common antigens that we think about, things like CD4, CD7, CD8, these can intermittently be lost in T cell lymphomas, which makes the diagnosis quite challenging. And this is somewhat unlike B cell lymphomas. So we really root our diagnosis and we question every case that we see, and we really try and have a consensus pathology agreement that is really rooted in the histopathology and cell surface markers. And then in terms of molecular testing, we attempt to perform T-cell clonality testing on every patient. So this is looking for T-cell gene rearrangements. And this can be a little bit challenging in that certain non-malignant states like autoimmune conditions can actually demonstrate T-cell clonality. So we really use this in concert with the other components of pathology review. What's not necessarily mandatory in every diagnosis, but something that we do often attempt to learn more about T-cell lymphomas is targeted mutational sequencing. So as we're learning more about T-cell lymphomas and thinking about how to rationally apply therapies, that's something that we do attempt in many of the cases that we see.
And what is the standard for initial workup and stratification for treatment selection in PTCL?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And obviously something that we face every day in the clinic when we see patients with these disorders. And it's definitely our jumping off point in helping to take care of them and work with them on their care journey. So from our perspective, you know, what we find helpful is routine labs that we get on everybody. So a complete blood count, metabolic panel, lactate dehydrogenase. We typically would test for HTLV-1, even in patients without clear risk factors by geography or a family history, to be thorough and make sure that that's not present here, because that would lead to a diagnosis of ATL if it were positive. We also, as an institutional standard, obtain hepatitis serologies and recommend HIV testing for thoroughness before embarking on therapy for these lymphomas. In terms of staging, our bias here is to be really as complete as possible. There are historical data showing that bone marrow biopsy and PET CT do add additional layers of information that can carry some prognostic importance. So both of those we would consider to be standard here, and we do recommend for all patients. Once those staging markers are completed and we have baseline blood work, really we then think about stratifying patients and understanding what are their goals for therapy, what are their preferences, what are their comorbidities, and what is the outlook for them going forward. We rely predominantly on the International Prognostic Index, but there is also the PIT index as well that we can score and we could potentially use to understand the outlook for each patient. It doesn't necessarily change management in every case, but we do find it helpful just to get a sense for what the outlook could be in the future.
Having discussed the initial workup, evaluation, and prognostication for peripheral T-cell lymphomas, we can then consider our initial treatment approach. In general, the first main branch point is a patient's candidacy for intensive multi-agent chemotherapy, which is generally our preference outside of a prospective trial. For older or more frail or comorbid patients where this approach may not be safe or feasible, we would then consider palliative oral chemotherapy instead. A lot of this has to do with what is a patient's goals and preferences for therapy and understanding the potential risks and potential benefits with a more intensive approach. So in general, that's how we think about the initial workup, staging and evaluation, and prognostication and treatment approach for patients with new diagnosis of peripheral T-cell lymphoma, making shared decision-making and understanding what the best approach is, balancing potential efficacy with potential toxicity.
So what are the current standards for therapy selection in the frontline setting? And as this is a complex topic, you can touch on one or more mainstays of treatment.
Yes, so choosing upfront therapy in T-cell lymphoma can be quite challenging. Historically, the regimens have been borrowed from aggressive B-cell lymphomas. So regimens such as CHOP or CHOEP have been used in the upfront treatment of T-cell lymphomas. And this is what we consider at least one standard upfront approach. There have been more intensive regimens such as CHOP-ICE or Hyper-CVAD, which have also been used historically. So we do use an anthracycline-based approach, so CHOP or the addition of etoposide as well in the regimen such as CHOEP or EPOC for the upfront treatment of patients with T-cell lymphoma. An extremely important study in the treatment of T-cell lymphoma is the Echelon 2 trial, which evaluated patients with CD30 positive disease. And this was a randomized trial that incorporated a CD30 antibody drug conjugate called brentuximab vedotin in the upfront treatment of patients with T-cell lymphoma. These were patients with CD30 positive disease, and this was actually a randomized trial of the regimen BVCHP versus CHOP in patients with newly diagnosed T-cell lymphoma. And it's actually the only trial in this disease that has ever shown a survival benefit. So for patients with CD30 positive disease, we often very strongly consider using the regimen BVCHP, and that would definitely be considered a standard of care. Other things that we think about but are not necessarily incorporated into the upfront therapy selection, we do use, as Dr. Epstein-Peterson mentioned, prognostic indices such as the IPI or PIT score, but there really have been no validated prospective evaluations of using these scores to guide therapy, but we do use them in our evaluation of upfront patients. And then, like I mentioned, mutational sequencing, we're starting to learn about patients that may or may not benefit from this approach, such as mutations like TP53 or other mutations that we see in other high-risk lymphoid malignancies. And we're starting to learn about how to use those findings to guide our therapy selection. And then the last point I want to mention is on high-dose therapy with stem cell rescue, so auto transplant in first remission for patients with T-cell lymphoma. there's never been a randomized trial evaluating observation versus auto transplant for patients who achieve a first remission, but there have been multiple prospective evaluations and retrospective studies which have evaluated the use of auto transplant. And while somewhat controversial, there does seem to be a benefit in applying auto transplant in patients who achieve a remission, and especially a complete remission, to upfront therapy. So we heavily take into account patient preferences, but we often discuss an auto transplant, elicit patient preferences, have them meet with a transplant specialist, and think about that if patients do achieve a remission to induction.
And what are the current standards for therapy selection in the relapse setting?
That's a great question. Really, it depends on a number of factors that we take into account in that specific scenario. The things that we think about kind of on the ground when we're seeing patients and helping to make these decisions, number one, what was the prior therapy that they received? Number two, what was their tolerability of that therapy? Number three, what was the response, if any, and the duration of response? Number four, what are their future goals and preferences and current comorbid status? And then number five, for patients who are thinking about a potential allogeneic transplantation in the future, we do start to think about who the donor might be and the availability and match there. So taking all that together, you know, the first branch point that I think we use clinically is what is the goal for each patient? Broadly, we would think of this in one of two categories. For some patients, it's clear that the goal will be to induce another remission if they were in remission before, or to get them into remission for the first time if they were primary refractory, and then to consolidate that subsequent response with an allogeneic stem cell transplantation. That requires a lot of planning and a lot of careful attention and weighing the potential risks and benefits of that therapeutic approach. But it's one thing that we do really do as a first branch point with each patient in that therapeutic setting to try to understand if that may be on the table for them in the future. We have a very low threshold to at least refer to an allotransplant doctor at our institution to start having that conversation, because they're a little bit more on the ground in terms of what the risks are, the potential benefits, and they can help facilitate the donor search for those patients. If that is the goal, our bias has been to obviously try to get them back into remission as soon as possible and then go to transplant when that's achieved and done safely. Really, depending on the prior therapies, that can be done with either non-cross-reactive chemotherapy compared to what they got before. Other therapeutic options would include agents like romidepsin or duvelisib. That's been a more recent advance in the field. But those are the broad categories that we would think about in terms of the therapies for such patients. For patients for whom allotransplant is not the ultimate goal, and it's more of a maintenance type approach where the goal would be to prolong survival and address symptoms, but typically we don't expect that we will cure or eradicate the disease in that context. And so typically it would take the shape of sequential therapies given over time. They're typically given on an ongoing basis until intolerance or if the disease would break through each therapy. In that context, some of the agents that we would think about using, again, conventional chemotherapy, ideally non-cross-reactive with what was given before. So agents like pralatrexate are often used in this context. Romidepsin is another agent as well that we do reach for in many instances, given its favorable toxicity profile, can be given on an ongoing basis. And then duvelisib is another promising agent that, again, has more recent data supporting its use in this context, can be given on an ongoing basis, a relatively favorable toxicity profile, and there can be patients who benefit for months or years without the goal of allotransplant ultimately. So it's a very individualized approach and really takes a lot of care to understand where is a patient at, what are the ultimate goals for therapy. The other thing I'll say is we have a very strong bias here at Memorial Sloan Kettering towards investigational approaches such as clinical trials, you know, as early as first in human or phase one. And then sometimes there are phase three trials in this therapeutic setting. We recognize a lot of unmet need in this disease space. And obviously the best way to combat that would be advancing promising agents and helping get them to patients. So that's another strong consideration. If there's a suitable trial and a patient is amenable, that would be something that we would think about to offer in that context.
And to wrap up, can you please review novel and emerging treatment strategies that clinicians practicing in the community should be aware of?
Yes. So one trial that's we think is quite important in this disease space is actually an upfront trial. So for patients with newly diagnosed T-cell lymphoma, there's an ongoing Alliance intergroup trial, which is actually randomizing patients to a control arm of CHOP or CHOEP versus two investigational arms. The first is duvelisib, which is the PI3 kinase inhibitor, in combination with CHOP or CHOEP. And the second arm is azacitidine in combination with CHOP or CHOEP. So this is a trial really designed to move active agents in the relapse setting into the frontline setting. Again, this is a randomized trial that is ongoing nationally, and we think that this is quite important to learn about upfront treatment strategies. And then in the relapse setting, duvelisib, as Dr. Epstein-Peterson mentioned, is now listed by the NCCN as a second-line agent. Its phase 2 trial has completed. There is a very exciting agent called valemetostat, which is an EZH1/2 inhibitor, which is near completion of a phase 2 trial, global phase 2 trial, another agent that we're quite excited about and to see results from. And then really in its infancy in T-cell lymphomas in comparison to B-cell lymphomas are cellular therapies. So data was recently presented on a CD70 agent, and there's multiple other investigational cellular therapies that are really in their infancy, but quite exciting in the future for T-cell lymphomas. We both recognize that this is a really challenging disease space. And so multiple agents are really moving through pipeline and hopefully entering the clinics. And we're starting to learn about how to apply these rationally and in combination with other investigational agents.
So is there anything else that you'd like to add that we didn't get to touch on in the interview?
I think, again, just thank you for having us and really recognizing the rarity, the heterogeneity, and the challenge in treating this disease. So we're always interested in learning from our patients as we try and help them in advancing the research in this clinical space.
The other thing that I would share is, and to echo what Dr. Stuber was saying, is we do find it beneficial to share cases with other academic institutions to learn about cases from them as well. So have a low threshold if there are any questions or concerns to share cases, discuss with colleagues and other faculty. Again, because it's an unmet disease area that are rare diseases in general, we have a very collaborative group of investigators across the country and across the world. And we think there's a lot of benefit there to really learn from each other and advance the field forward.
Well, thank you both for that in-depth analysis. It was really great speaking with you on the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.